Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast that takes a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Tosin Anafawakim.
This week, Google Glass gets its first real review. HP sells WebOS to LG. An Australian hacker knows the secrets of the next Xbox and PlayStation. Is Reddit being gamed by marketers? And how Netflix is using big data to turn us into their puppets. Okay, so the first story right off the bat here. Last week we talked about Google Glass. And one of the sort of concerns, Dwayne, that you had brought up was that all of these stories that we've been reading about how wonderful Google Glass is based on nothing, with no sort of firsthand experience,
no non-curated experience. There are people who had it, but it was always curated by Google.
Right. Well, last week, The Verge's Joshua Topolsky rocked the tech journalism world when he announced that he'd been given a so far exclusive first-hand test run of Google Glass's project. Writing in The Verge, he described the device as being made up of only a few basic pieces. The main body of glass is a soft-touch plastic that houses the brain's battery and counterweight. There's a thin middle strip that creates the arc of the glasses, and some rather typical pad arms and nose pads, which allow the device to rest on your face. He says that the Google will ship out a interchangeable sunglass accessory, which twists on or off easily. The device comes apart, separating the center metal rim from the brains and lens. The idea is that you can attach another frame fitted for glass that would completely alter the look of the device while still allowing for the heads-up functionality. And he went on to talk about the experience of using glass itself. He says, when you activate glass, here's what you see. The time is displayed with a small amount of text underneath that reads, "Okay, glass." That's how you get glass to wake up to your voice commands. It's a two-step process. You have to touch the side of the device, which is actually a touchpad, or tilt your head upward slowly, a gesture which tells glass to wake up. Once you've done that, you start issuing commands by speaking "Okay, glass" first, and then scroll through the options using your finger along the side of the device. You can scroll items by moving your finger backwards or forwards along the strip. You select by tapping and move back by swiping down, but most of the interaction is done by voice. And then he said that we talked about sort of how unrealistic the video that Google put up last week looked.
And how he said, highly produced it.
Yes. And he said, let me start by saying that using it is actually very nearly identical to what the company showed off in its newest demo video. That's not CGI. It's what glass is actually like to use. It's clean, elegant, and makes relative sense. The screen is not disruptive. You do not feel burdened by it. It's there and it's gone. It's not shocking. It's not jarring. It's just this new thing in your field of vision, and it's actually pretty cool. He says, what's it like to actually have glass on? To use it when you're walking around, it's kind of awesome. Think of it this way. If you get a text message or have an incoming call when you're walking down a busy street, there's something like two or three things you have to do before you can deal with that situation. Most of them involve completely taking your attention off of your task at hand, walking down the street. With glass, that information just appears to you in your line of sight, ready for you to take action on. And taking that action is a little more than touching the side of the glass or side of glass or tilting your head up. Nothing that would take you away from your main task of not running into people. It's a simple concept that feels powerful in practice. He says you still have to grapple with asking for directions with glass, but removing the barrier of completely being distracted by the device in your hand is significant, and actually receiving directions as you walk is even more significant. In the city, glass makes you feel more powerful, better equipped, and definitely less diverted. He also had some it wasn't all positive. He did say that Google Glass had some definite improvements in what it needed to do.
Well, can we go to a little bit of the context of the situation? I mean, I remember a couple, maybe 5, 8, 9 months ago.
Yeah.
John Gruber was given a look at Mountain Lion on a new iMac. He had this 1,200-page situation on his 1,200-word situation on his blog, and he gushed over it. And he, you know, he had exclusive access to the, you know, nearly exclusive access to this. Apple picked him up and took him to an apartment in New York where he showed everything and yada yada yada.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And I could not help but feel a lot of the same level of buddy-buddy between manufacturer and blogger here. I felt as if what I saw, you know, there was an interview, there was a lot of smiling, and, you know, I felt like the guy here, he didn't review the product. He didn't take it to task as much as he was like, this is, you know, Google hooked me up and they took me over to their, you know, space in New York, and I got to like play with this thing and it was really cool and yada yada yada. I didn't see a lot of like, I don't know, it didn't.
He
feel,
did have
it,
some criticism.
Even when he had some criticism, but even when you see the video, it was again highly produced. It wasn't a question.
Well, highly
of, like,
produced by
see,
The Verge, it, not by Google. Well, I mean, have you seen The Verge's other video?
I've
productions?
Seen a lot of their videos.
They're
a lot
all
of their videos,
highly produced like that. Yeah.
What their videos remind me of in many ways some CNET videos, right. Like they're well produced.
I don't think that has anything to do with the question of sort of the impartiality of his reporting.
Oh, I think it does. I think he got access, and having access, you know, when you have
sure.
Access,
well, the thing is, we talked about this briefly. Is that this is a single data point? We only have the one reporter's experience so far. Now, Tosin, you said that you had a friend who had some access to Google Glass as well. So you have some secondhand experience with this.
Yeah,
as well.
No, I have some secondhand experience. And, you know, of course, I'm sure there's plenty of things which he couldn't say. But at least from what I was hearing, he really enjoyed it. And if he, you know, if he hadn't gone ahead and performed adequately and, you know, got himself, won himself a free pair, he said that he still would have paid full price for it if it was $1,500. That was the degree that he enjoyed the experience. And it was basically, it was a kind of a hackathon experience where they got to build their own apps that leveraged Google Glass. So I think kind of pretty cool to know that they're also thinking about the ecosystem. I will say it is kind of amazing, you know, how much power Google has, because literally for that article, they were able to be like, well, you know, who do we want to have review us? The Verve. And they were, you know, able to get their pick of their litter. So there is that. I definitely understand where Duane's coming from too.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that we haven't got any insight into this device. We have got total insight into this device. We understand where it was before. We understand where it's going. We understand what they're trying to do. Additionally, the New York Times reported that Warby Parker, a newer eyeglass vendor who's noted for both their design and their ability to let people try on glasses without being there, have possibly been tapped by Google to help them.
And they certainly need help in that.
These spectacles.
Right. Like you had pointed out before the show how empirically ugly you thought Google Glass was.
No, I pointed out that they were not empirically beautiful. There's a very big difference. They're not empirically beautiful. They're not one of those things that people look at and like, oh, man, it's just so gorgeous. That's what I was saying before the show.
But this is still a beta project. This may not be the final form factor. There may be a lot of development to come. If you've seen the pictures in The Verge of what the prototype looked like to now, like extrapolate that to the time they release the product, and it may be something completely different. You know, but you
sure,
want to talk about
at, like, you know, ideally we're looking at something that's like, I don't know if you guys have seen the first Mission Impossible. Andy certainly has. I don't know if Tosin's old enough to have, but you know, they had like glasses with cameras built in. They had the ability to like communicate with people through those glasses and things like that. And they were glasses
the movie with
Tom Cruise and
yes, no, I mean I love that movie.
Yeah, it's a great movie, but they had like this technology that was impossible in 1990, whatever.
Yeah.
And I feel like if Google Glass can move to that place where it's just seamless, like your glasses happen to be Google glasses, now your glasses are technified before they're actually glasses. And you don't have to walk around looking in the in your upper right hand corner like that photo on The Verge. It looks as if he's about to bump into something. There's that. So I feel like, yeah, it's a beta product, and I get that. And it is great to see how the progress has moved from the original to what it is now. Although it can't get much worse than the original.
So that was pretty ugly.
I just want to keep it in perspective that it's not, you know, even, I mean, what I find is that Sapolsky spoke about like Google level design and how it could rival Apple.
Yeah.
And then just a couple of paragraphs down, he says, I will admit that wearing glass made me feel self-conscious, and maybe that's my paranoia, but I felt people staring at me. It made me feel uncomfortable, which goes to show that this is not a device which design fits in with the average individual, the muggle, let's call them, the way that they walk around the world, look at life.
But it's
way that so many like other devices have. You pull out a computer that, you know, like a MacBook Air, one of the current Ultrabooks, and people are like to say, wow, that looks really cool, or wow, look how thin that is, or wow, whatever.
No, see, I think that's less about design. I think what he's reacting to is a new paradigm, because this is something that no one is used to, a camera on the side of their face. Other than, you know, extreme sports participants. So, of course, you're going to feel it's not about the design itself making you feel self-conscious. It's about the idea that you're walking around essentially spying on everyone that you're.
Sure. What I'm saying is that everyone who I made eye contact with while in glass seemed to be just about to say, hey, right. What the hell is that?
Of course, they're not used to seeing that yet.
Sure. And I remember the first time I pulled out my mom's cell phone at the time, people said, what the hell is that? In an interested way. Then about, what the hell is that? And that's what I'm saying. It's something that, you know, it's just not, I don't know. I'm not trying to say that this is bullshit or anything like that. Right. What I am saying is that there is an inconsistency with his talk about Google level design versus his discussion about the fact that people were like,
right, Apple level design. But you'll also keep in mind that when the first Apple iPhone came out, it was an amazing product and we all oohed and aahed, but it couldn't even copy and paste. So, I mean, there were huge hurdles from the first iteration of that to what we've got today.
Chris had the best layout for this. Chris Bernor popped in and he said that it shows that on some level, Apple is a company that that likes to design the product before figuring out the engineering hurdles,
right. Whereas
Google likes to figure out the engineering hurdles before designing the product.
Sure. No, that you definitely have a point there. I mean, that is Google's sort of, I don't want to say weak point, but it's definitely the difference between Google and Apple. Now, you want to talk about slanted sort of marketing. I think like a real example of that is Sergey Brin doing a talk at TED and telling the audience that smartphones are, quote, emasculating. He said they're he said that smartphones.
Who cares?
Showing off Google Glass, he said that smartphones are emasculating. You're standing around just rubbing this featureless piece of glass. Now that to me feels like very self-serving for an upcoming product that he's going to want to sell to everybody.
I didn't really understand what was, like, even when he was talking about it, I didn't really understand what was emasculating about.
Yeah, I'm not clear about that either.
I feel like word
confusion.
Somebody, I think it was one of the, there was a film, and one of the, like, Anderson brothers, it was a Wes Anderson film, and one of, like, those two brothers that are always in his films. The guys who talk funny.
Oh, sure, sure.
Wilson brothers. He was in there, and he was a spy. And he said this really funny thing, like, don't you get it? New technology is the opposite of old technology. It's not about being big and bulky. It's like how small. It's like the opposite of like sort of like the typical masculine, like I got a big penis kind of thing. It's like it's how small and fragile can you be? And he pulls out this phone that is like the tiniest little thing ever, and he puts it daintily to his ear. And if that's what Sergey Brin's talking about, then fine. That's emasculating. But so I'll give him that because that's just like one of those things that's funny. But yeah, I didn't really see that. I don't know that having technology be a big, bulky, extra gas-guzzling, like vroom vroom thing is how I define myself as a man. But maybe that's the way Sergey does it. And I mean, the man is rich, so he got something right.
What I thought was really interesting about the basically, there's a meta level to this whole conversation about Google Glass that we're talking about, especially when it comes to the reporting on Glass and the interest. And you sent me a link from VentureBeat that I thought had a really interesting quote in it, and it was John Cotsier. And he's writing in VentureBeat an article called Google Glass is a giant chisel to pry me out of Apple's ecosystem. And he said, Glass generates that intense interest not only because it looks like a window to the future of a less intrusive, more helpful technology, but also because in it, I think we sense the birth struggles of the new human, hacked, connected, augmented, enhanced, and yeah, way geekier. Because let's face it, this omnipresent and desperately striving for omniscience technology is not going to stop with glasses or connected bits of glass and metal that perch on or hang off our bodies. 15 or 20 generations of glasses later, we'll have a Google contact. We'll lose the Borg and regain our bodies. After that, it'll be implants running off energy your body provides. Now, I think all of this conversation about Google Glass goes beyond reporters being sucked into the Google Glass marketing machine. The reason so many people are talking about it is because
I just want to acknowledge that you just said what you just said. There's like this huge marketing machine. That's the only problem I have with the technology. I think is transformative.
Right.
The technology does allow for new things, but it's really interesting to hear Sergey Brin talk about how a phone is emasculating when the technology relies currently on your phone. This device is not designed to have a cellular modem in it. It talks to your phone the way that the Pebble Watch talks to your phone.
At this stage.
At
who
this
knows?
Stage, and I think it's important to look at that. Well, who knows? Maybe the Pebble Watch will have a cellular modem in it. But for me, and I think I spoke to you earlier about this, the idea is that these devices that are using your cellular telephone as a data hub, a way to get data to them and transfer data out of them, they're redefining mobile. Mobile not as the square in your pocket.
Absolutely.
But mobile as the less intrusive device that sort of begins to touch the devices that we're
as technology
we
wherever you are.
Exactly. It's even more than that. There's an ergonomic understanding to this idea that there was a time, let's say back in the late 90s, when people who were on the web for the web's sake. They were on the web because they could do certain things. They were really focused on certain functionality. And to get on the web, you had to kind of like figure out what the web was, what was possible on the web, and then you had to kind of work within those constraints. When what we call Web 2.0 showed up, where an encyclopedia became part of the web, and Facebook brought MySpace brought people to the web because people were able to communicate the way they're used to communicating, just using the web as a forum for that, then we began to see a transformative space in the internet. And I feel like that's what we're beginning to see with these new technologies. The idea that the square in your pocket is sort of out of the norm for the 20th and 21st century understanding of what we need, what we want technology to do for us. Things like glasses, things like watches, those are things that are in our culture and tied in already. And if we can get those to behave in new and exciting ways, using the square in your pocket as a bridge to get the data, eventually – you know, they'll just kind of be on their own. They'll be small and tiny and cute and neat, and they'll just have this functionality built into them. And I feel like that's what we're seeing as the change in mobile. To me, that's part of the bigger conversation about Google Glass.
Sure, that's why everyone's talking about it. This because it is such a transformative device. It could have been made by anybody. Google just happened to do it. And sure, as you mentioned last week, other people have made similar devices, but up until now, these have been niche gadgets relegated to specialty uses like extreme sports. What Google is attempting to do is democratize the technology, put it on everybody's face, make it ubiquitous, make it a part of our lives. In the same way that the iPhone revolutionized mobile technology, Apple didn't perfect a better mobile phone. They democratized the concept of owning a pocket computer. And I think it's a very important difference in what Google's doing here as well.
And I
don't know if I completely agree with that, because I feel like I think only Google could make Google Glass. I'll put that out there. I don't think that anyone else could have shown up and been able to put this together in a way that people would have taken notice of.
I think this would have happened eventually, but I think Google is probably the best. It's the perfect storm.
They're best suited for right now. And I also think that when Apple showed up with the iPhone, they weren't democratizing anything. The thing costs $600 or $400.
And people paid it.
people paid it, but everybody it wasn't democratizing paid it. When they democratized it, was that second iteration at $200 a device. That was a democratization of it, getting it into the hands of the middle class.
But everyone class could
and
not see that if everyone didn't buy it, they knew that they wanted it and they wanted to own it. So
sort of, there were lots of people who had smartphones at the time, the pre-app, pre.
Right. But they.
What I'm saying is, it's not. Sure. My whole point is that it's not really the same. Google has something that is very different from any kind of mobile technology we've ever seen in these glasses.
Yeah.
Apple transformed the smartphone. And I think it was a big transformation, and it made a lot of things possible. But I think when Apple's thing came up, the skepticism showed up, not because they were like, no one really knows what's going on here or whatever. That was, a finished device that was out. This was mostly the idea that when it came with the Apple iPhone, the idea was, yeah, it's got a lot of flashy stuff, but it doesn't do what I needed to do. Once it began doing what people needed to do, it was awesome. With Google Glass, people's imaginations have gone wild in a way they haven't with Apple's. Not until at least the SDK showed up for iOS 2.0. I think the Google Glass is more futuristic than the iPhone was. That's partly because it hasn't arrived yet.
Let's talk a little bit about the change, and we touched upon this briefly last week, but the change to the social contract that I think Google Glasses are going to affect. Let's see, Anton Wallman in The Street wrote in an article called Watch Out for Google Glasses, or Is Google Glass Bad for Society? He says that Google Glasses will impact societal behavior from the moment they arrive. As soon as you see them, you're aware that you might be filmed. People don't like being filmed. Yes, every smartphone can record you and take pictures, but you know when this is happening. It isn't a constant feeling that everyone around you is filming you from every angle. You see them when they do it. Google Glasses are different, more than just photos and filming. What happens to this data? Let's say I'm standing behind the counter at a business establishment, bank, fast food restaurant, airline, check-in counter, whatever. My Google Glasses might display the social security number, the general rap sheet, social media appearances, and so on, of the person in front of me. Perhaps it's a good thing. Perhaps some people will think it's creepy. Can you imagine the bar scene when people start wearing Google Glasses? Within a second or two, you'll have all the information about the person in front of you. Some of that information may not be so flattering. Public places will have to come up with new policies. Hotel, airports, restaurants, gyms, and schools will want some say in whether you're allowed to wear these glasses on the premises. You can hear the panic buttons after the first pictures from people cheating in school or filming the locker room are released on YouTube. Other dimensions immediately appear. What if future versions of Google Glasses are very difficult to detect in terms of looking different from regular glasses? What happens when you walk into an establishment today wielding a video camera in the faces of the staff? You'll be asked to turn that thing off, and if you don't obey quickly, you'll be escorted from the premises. Google Glasses will make all social public interaction highly awkward. You're on YouTube everywhere you go. A few short months after their introduction, Google Glasses could already be so widespread that you'll be on camera once you stick your nose out the front door.
So to a certain extent, I can definitely see where his fears are coming from. Everyone's going to be – data will be more instantaneous and more in your face. But didn't we kind of go through some of that with the cell phone already?
We totally went through that with the cell, especially when you showed up in a concert. It's like, oh, you can't have your cell phone. You're going to have to lock it up over here. Even with the Elf cameras, I think as long as Google Glass remains identified as Google Glass, I don't see there being a huge problem in the world other than the problems that we have today. Oh, could you take that off when you come in here? It's when Google Glass, when the Google's partnership, supposedly with Warby Parker or Paul Frank or whoever else makes glasses, when that comes to a point where the glasses are small enough, thin enough, or whatever enough not to be distinguishable, easily distinguishable from regular glasses, that you have that issue. I think that people may behave completely differently in public because we had the Facebook problem. Remember where people would do things like, hey, I'm not coming into work because I'm sick, but the pictures of them would be on Facebook. we had that problem already. And the society, I think, especially that generation, has learned a little bit about how they can behave. And we still have the problem with the hot mics. You can't tell when a mic is hot, which is why, during the election, both Barack Obama and Mitt Romney said things on hot microphones that did not appeal to everybody. In fact, turned people off in some respects. people are always going to be sensitive about what they're saying in public. This is going to make them more sensitive, and I think the negative aspect of society we'll have to deal with will likely be in people sort of not being themselves,
right.
Unless everybody in the space is not wearing glasses. You know what I mean?
We're going to evolve into an involuntarily social society.
We'll become more conservative, is what will happen, because we're afraid of exposing ourselves in a way that we didn't intend to.
Right. Which also kind of brings up this next story about this Kuzu, this app for your iPhone. So basically what this is an app for your iPhone that you would install on like an iPhone that you're not using. You can, of course, install it on your current iPhone. But the idea is it allows you to use your old iPhone or iPod Touch and soon Android devices. You set up a video stream over either Wi-Fi or 4G. The company will even mail you a Windows suction cup mount to give your old device the best possible view. And it allows you to turn that old device into a streaming, always-on webcam. It doesn't transmit audio in order to preserve some semblance of privacy. And the company should be concerned about that, because what gives you the right to stream live video of your neighbor's front yard? Kuzu's terms of service dictate that only public spaces can be streamed by users, but Kuzu founder Drew Sechrist knows everyone isn't going to stick to the rules. Unless the front yard is obscured in some way, it's visible to general public. He says, I do expect there'll be a large dynamic public discussion about this with many varying viewpoints expressed, but that doesn't mean users aren't going to live stream videos of their bedroom. So just like Instagram and Vine, Kuzu will face a never-ending struggle with users who cross the boundaries of what's acceptable as public content. So again, we have another example here of this device that is
can change the way that we deal with each other, yeah, socially.
And obviously, it's not the first device ever to be a connected spy cam, but it makes the process so easy that it democratizes it. You know, it allows anyone to turn their old cell phones.
Yeah, I gotta say I'm kind of excited about this. On some level, I'm a little scared too. We always talk about Big Brother as, you know, the government doing the Iron Ring. The Iron Ring is the what people refer to as the thousands upon thousands of CCTV, closed caption TV cameras in London.
The London authorities
can take a look almost on any block in downtown London and determine where someone is. They can track you just like not unlike what you've seen in TV shows like 24 or Enemy of the State or other things like that, where the surveillance is such that they can track someone around.
This persons of interest
takes that concept, and I think it rightly does. I mean, the term democratized does really come to mind, because suddenly, I mean, Kuzu is more than just, hey, put your camera online. It's a network. If you look at Kuzu's app, Kozoo, you download that onto your phone. You have two options, really. You can just kind of take pictures of places when you're around on your current phone, or you can take an older phone that you're not using or an iPod Touch or whatever and put it out, as Andy said. The idea, though, is if you take a look at the app right now, you go to San Francisco, there are a bunch, like little location icons pop up everywhere and showing you where you can take a look at what's going on in San Francisco. And that's kind of exciting. For me, you know, I'm in Boulder. There's complete geek culture here and everything. I see myself – at first I was like, oh, I'll just put this – in my window to take a look at my front walk, and I'll be able to check in at my front walk. And then I was thinking, do I really want people to be able to look in my window and see like an iPhone there so they can like, you know, like either wonder about me or break into whatever? Like, you're going to have to find really like sort of like inconspicuous places to put these phones, which leads to the whole sneakiness of it. Do you want an iPhone just kind of hanging out behind a glass plate that is your window, so someone could break in and take it, because they're still valuable even if they're old? So you're gonna have to find ways to hide them. And while finding ways to hide them, you're sort of forced to sneak the visual onto people. Isn't that weird?
Basically, we're just gonna have to get used to the fact that we're always on camera. We're always. I mean, people in London have been used to that for years, as you mentioned before.
And they're less conservative than Americans for the most part.
Yeah. Although, you know what's interesting about that whole situation in London, the Iron Ring, is that they're running into sort of they're being confounded by the monetary limitations. In other words, that a lot of those cameras are not manned anymore because they just don't have the people to. There are more cameras than there are people to watch the video.
Yeah, I mean, there's some techniques to like help out with that, you know, like motion detection or whatever. But if it's in a public place, there's a lot of motion detection. So you're gonna have to build smart. I mean, Kuzu's already smart software in that it's networking and this hardware in a way that's scalable. You're gonna have to build even smarter software to help you determine what's going on the screen and whether or not it's right. Like stuff of interest.
All right, let's move on here. Today it was announced, and this is Thursday we're recording this. It was announced that Groupon will replace Andrew Mason as its CEO. The decision comes the day following the reporting of its painful fourth quarter financial performance that included a surprise loss and lukewarm revenues. Andrew Mason released a witty statement on the transition. He said, people of Groupon, after 4.5 intense and wonderful years as CEO of Groupon, I've decided that I'd like to spend more time with my family. Just kidding. I was fired today. He went on to say, for those who are concerned about me, please don't be. I love Groupon, and I'm terribly proud of what we've created. I'm okay with having failed at this part of the journey. If Groupon was Battletoads, it would be like I made it all the way to the Terra Tubes without dying on my first ever playthrough. So, I mean, the guy's got a sense of humor in his departure, I suppose. But I'm not surprised about this. This continues Groupon's downward spiral since its, you know, hugely popular launch and IPO. It's basically been downward since then. And I think we talked about this before on the drill down, how the business model of Groupon is flawed in that Groupon doesn't have a moat. You know, it's not a concept that is unique to the company. It is a concept that can be co-opted by other companies, and it has been, but Living Social and Amazon Deals, and so Groupon didn't have any sort of like indigenous lock to the
idea. Had no IP protection.
Right. Well, and
jumped in it.
And on top of all of everything else, it's incredibly manpower intensive because you need to staff people to go looking for these deals and making these deals with all of these local vendors. So, I mean, this is not a surprise to me to see Groupon spiraling downward.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's interesting. I don't know if it's actually spiraling downward as much as it's a lot of times when you have a person with a vision who starts a company, that company gets big, you have to change up leadership when the scale hits a certain level. It's how you navigate it. So you look at Google, and they did a very good job, right? Like, they got to a place where they got Eric Schmidt in because they were like, look, we're getting too big. We are two PhD dudes. We're not exactly, you know, Fortune 100 CEO material. Yeah. Let's get somebody in here who knows. Let's talk to this guy, Eric Schmidt. He's at Google. He's at Apple. He might have a chance. He might have something for us. And he did. And they took those years where Eric Schmidt was the CEO, and they learned. And eventually Larry came and took his place back. That didn't happen with Google. It's almost like they, Groupon. It's almost like they grew too fast without the insight to understand that they're not the people to – they didn't have the experience to run the show at that level. So I feel like it's a shame that this guy had to get removed in the way he did. If he had navigated the world of fast-growing companies a little better, he could have said, okay, these are the steps we're going to make. But it sounds like he didn't have that experience there to help curate what they were doing, how they were doing it, and then, you know, allow for some of the pitfalls that Groupon went through to not go through them.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, it's one of the things which I recently got to hear addressed by one of our venture capitals from General Atlantic. was kind of how difficult it can be in the marketplace for consumer brand applications and websites. You know, a lot of the ones we've seen over the course of the last few years, when they've gone IPO, they've, you know, gone sharply up, and then they've started going on this downward spiral, because it is at times it's a hard model in which to, you know, become profitable and generate revenue. Even Facebook at times, you know, they are doing better and trying different mechanisms of commoditizing, but it's relatively difficult since, you know, ad revenue isn't the same as it previously was.
Let's move on here. So HP is going to sell key pieces of its webOS product and team to LG for use in smart TVs. LG's plan include the possibility of eventually producing a phone or other mobile devices that run webOS, although the company remains focused on televisions in the short term. LG will acquire the source code, documentation, websites, and team behind the client side of webOS, but HP is going to retain the entire cloud services division, that's the app catalog, updating system, and other back-end services that interact with webOS. Importantly, HP will retain all the patents associated with Palm and webOS. LG is going to license it from HP. LG will commit to continued participation in the open-source webOS project, and HP expects to benefit from LG's further development of webOS in the future. So webOS isn't dead. Although we're not really sure what LG is doing with it.
I mean, I tell you what they're not doing. They didn't put it in the damn printers. I thought they were going to put it in the damn printers. I wanted a touchscreen printer.
Yeah, apparently it's going to be in their TVs. So I think
I guess I bought an HP Envy printer because it was supposed to be all touchscreen, apps and shit like that and whatever. Apps don't freaking work. I can't do it. It doesn't do anything online. It prints. That's all it does. It doesn't do jack diddly squat. And the fact that they're like, I'm going to give up and just give this to LG. Yeah. I think that it's probably a good thing, because LG will actually do something with it. But HP, man, like, HP's been through so many ups and downs in the last few years. Like, oh, we're going to sell the whole company and all the stuff and just do, like, consulting services. Like, no, we're not going to do that. Oh, we bought WebOS and Palm. Oh, we're going to shut it down. I don't know. They don't know what they're doing.
It sounds like they're still getting the better end of the deal, because they keep the patents and
they're smart to license it. They played the patent game and they know what's up. And LG is like, I don't need this necessarily. As long as I get my licenses, I'm doing it. I'm interested to see the implementation on television. I mean, it was made for phones and tablets, touchscreen type devices. But it is very easy to code in, apparently, and very easy to get lots of things done. So,
yeah, I know there were a lot of people who were really interested in it going out to be public and free for communal use, but it doesn't seem like it's going that direction anymore.
If it's of use to somebody, to some company like LG, if they can use it. I think LG is, more than anything else, they're hedging their bets against completely going with an Android-based system. So, you know, it's worth the gamble, I guess. And it doesn't kill anybody for them to keep WebOS alive.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you got it. As long as someone can find an application for it in the private sector, I'm excited about it. What we didn't get into about Google Glass that I think would be helpful here is this idea that from what we've been able to see, it's more powerful than Siri in terms of being able to, like, open your mouth and communicate with the services and the device. That kind of functionality on a television screen would kind of be the holy grail, especially if it's like a really high resolution one. So I don't know what they're doing with Palm OS, but if they're able to push it and get it up to speed with Android, with where iOS is, and use some of that voice activated functionality, and still, like, maintain that mobile OS footprint that isn't too heavy on, like, the hardware or whatever, then I think we'll see some really interesting things coming out of LG. I mean, they have smart refrigerators, they have smart washing machines, they have smart ovens, they have smart everything. They're smart people, so, you know, I'm interested in seeing what they want to do here, because they can really probably pull some things off.
Speaking of, you know, Google Glass and TV interfaces, can you imagine just to extend the sort of laziness of the American experience, you know, a remote where you don't have to hold a remote. It's in your glasses, and you just tell your glasses to change
the
channel.
Well, we're kind of already there with the Kinect, right? Like the idea that you don't need a remote.
Oh, yeah.
If your Xbox is working, you can kind of motion and, you know, do that Minority Report sort of like you're in Netflix and or Metro, and you're kind of like moving the what we used to call the Metro interface back and forth with your hands and choosing things or whatever. So yeah, I can see, but I can see glass. Glass, iOS, it's all capable of, or should be all capable of, like, running another system in terms of simple actions to make things pause, play, eject, yada yada yada. I think it'd be really funny to see Google Glass with a Netflix app. People watching Netflix on their Google Glasses.
Such a tiny screen to be watching any sort of.
But how big does it look when it's that close to your eye?
That's a good question. That's a very good question.
I don't know if I could do that. But what I would do is during the time while I'm watching a movie on Netflix on my TV, be looking up information about it. Like that dual screen.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I would be doing that.
I mean, you don't do that
time.
Already? I do that with my iPad. Every time I'm sitting in front of a TV, I can't do it without my iPad.
But you don't have to take
your
eyes off.
I could just be like, take a photo of this person. Who is that guy? You know, that sort of thing. Rather than actually have to do the legwork of looking up the show. And
Hulu kind of does that now already.
Hulu does that, and so does Shazam will recognize TV shows and tell you what's going on as well. And there's actually technology that I'm working with that is poised to do something similar. So that is the future.
All right, let's take a moment to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment. For listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book that I want to recommend this week is called Argo, How the CIA and Hollywood Pulled Off the Most Audacious Rescue in History by Antonio Mendez and Matt Baglio. Now, this is, of course, the book that was the basis for the movie directed and starring Ben Affleck that just won Best Picture Oscar. On November 4th, 1979, Iranian militants stormed the American embassy in Tehran and captured dozens of American hostages, sparking a 444-day ordeal and a quake in global politics still reverberating today. But a little-known footnote to the crisis, six Americans escaped, and a mid-level agent named Antonio Mendez devised an ingenious yet incredibly risky plan to rescue them. I remember this Iran hostage crisis when it actually was going
down.
What
year was it?
1979.
Oh, I don't remember much of 1979.
Oh, yes.
Or any of it.
I remember watching TV, and every single day there'd be an update to how many days into the crisis they were. And I think this was a fantastic movie. I think this book actually started as an article in Wired magazine, which is a fantastic article. If you get a chance to read it, maybe I'll link to
an
that.
An article in Wired from 1979?
No, the book is new, but it started out as an article in Wired and then was expanded into this book. But that book or any of Audible's other 100,000 plus titles can be yours for free. And all you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. That's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook and a chance to check out their service. I'm curious. Maybe I'll put this on my list. I've seen the movie, but I'd love to hear the real story. I know that Ben Affleck sort of embellished a bit off of the actual events and made things a little bit more sort of, you know, overly dramatic.
Dramatic and American.
Yes.
Did he like fly to a what's it called? An asteroid in the middle of it and blow it up? Just checking.
No, Bruce Willis was busy.
Have you seen the movie, Dwayne?
No, I won't see it until I finish reading the book.
Ah, oh, okay. All right, cool. So there we go.
Also, it has Ben Affleck in it. So.
Ah, well, that is definitely, he's definitely, I have to admit, the weak link in the,
I mean, maybe he's awesome in the film.
He's,
you know,
not.
Like he's maybe he's matured or something.
No, I mean, yes, I think he has matured, but he's not. He's probably the weakest actor in the ensemble.
Can I just say that you look at Good Will Hunting with Ben Affleck and Matt Damon, and you look at the direction those two careers have gone, and it's like night and day. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah,
One is like,
yeah, Matt's, I mean, very Daredevil. Versatile.
Daredevil.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. He's had some low points, but as a director, man, he's gotten some.
Yeah. Yeah.
He has gotten the accolades as well as.
What else has he directed?
Gone Baby Gone and The Town. Was it The Town? Yeah.
Yep. Oh, I didn't want to see either of those.
Gone Baby Gone is excellent. I haven't seen The Town, but I would argue that Ben Affleck's probably a better director now than he ever was an actor.
Oh, okay. Because I remember seeing the ads for The Town. And I'm like, oh, another Boston crime situation. Oh, look, the bad guy is dating the girl that's the girl of interest. Oh, that's surprising. Nope.
The Town was pretty good, but Gone Baby Gone was excellent.
Okay.
Quite frankly, surprisingly,
how did The Town compare to his Departed? Movies are,
I would say that The Departed was more of a thriller, and The Town was more of a slower type of drama. It's hard to say. I mean, they have similar aspects. I would have to say The Departed was a better film because it's stronger lead roles, while The Town, you know, The Town did have Ben Affleck and Jeremy Renner in it, Blake Lively, but I feel like together the cast in The Departed was better. I think it's a more solid movie.
Mm.
Okay. So once again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for Argo, the Argo book, or any of their other titles. If you've never signed up for Audible, definitely use that link because it helps us out on the show. We're going to take a little break here and listen to some music. And when we return, we're going to talk about an amazing story of a guy who hacked his way into getting his hands on the next yet unreleased Xbox and PlayStation. So take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas and Tosin Anafawakin. Let's talk about this story, story in Kotaku. So on Tuesday, February 19th, members of the Western Australian Computer Crimes Force, allegedly aided by the FBI, raided the home of Super DAE, also known as Dan Henry, also known as Dylan, last name redacted. They took his computers, they took his phone, and froze his assets. Now, apparently this Australian hacker known as Super DAE had been in contact with Kotaku reporter Stephen Totillo for some time. He claimed to know about the next Xbox and PlayStation, claimed to really have two prototype versions of the next Xbox. He said he had access to next-gen games, that he had Homefront 2, Sleeping Dogs 2, and he'd played Gears of War a year before it came out. He said he drunkenly told Epic about that, and they sent him a poster. So he's hacked Epic, allegedly hacked Epic, Valve, Blizzard, THQ. He got development documentation for the next PlayStation and Xbox. He tricked Microsoft into sending him at least one, if not more than one, future Xbox development kit. I mean, this guy's story, we're going to link to the story But I definitely recommend this as a read for everybody. It's a little long, but it's totally worth it because this guy has just is single-handedly sort of launched himself into epic hacker status. Did you guys read this article?
Yeah.
What did you think about this guy's exploits?
Convincing, dramatic. It's a it's a telltale thing. It's good shit. I mean, he knows how to manipulate people in a pretty phenomenal way.
Social engineering at its best too, but also it's quite an interesting individual. You know, a lot of talent there, and it's curious to see, you know, how long he was able to get away with what he has been doing, Actually, I think what I find really compelling is kind of the reaction by the various corporations, which are,
right,
to a certain extent, you know, some of them quite different than what you would see from, like, the NPAA, right?
Right. I mean, NPAA,
they don't necessarily hire FBI agents to go out and lead teams or, like, you know, lead teams of foreign police to go raid people's houses.
That's true. But it's interesting.
Not that they're above that. I could see them totally being into that. It's just, this is far more effective, I think.
It's interesting that a lot of these game developers, apparently, according to the story, he wasn't a sort of black hat hacker. He'd called up a lot of these companies and told them about their vulnerabilities that allowed him to get into their email and file systems. And many of them, you know, thanked him and sort of gave him, like, sort of rewards, not as compensation, but just basically in exchange for pointing out the vulnerabilities of these systems, even while he was sort of like thumbing his nose in front of these companies and bragging about how much data and, you know, physical material that he had access to.
He would tell them. He kind of pulled a Palpatine here, yeah. Right? He was kind of like, I'm the guy helping you out, but I'm also the guy hurting you, right? Like,
right.
Now that I've gotten all your secrets, I'm going to tell you how I got them, but I'm going to keep them and do whatever I want with them.
Right. It's funny. There's one of the situations where he said that he had access to turning off banks of servers at Microsoft. He says, there are issues where I can log into a power board in Microsoft and switch off 1,000 servers. The reporter had some well-deserved skepticism, and then he showed them, like, login screens where he showed him these outlet controls for these servers and that he could actually do this. The thing about this is that this article, this reporter has brought up these questions to this hacker to prove sort of his abilities, and this hacker has been very generous about documenting all of the sort of documenting his ability to do all of this. So it's a fairly confident claim that he's been able to do what he said he's been able to do.
Yeah, I mean, he had to back it up, and I think the reporter did a great job of saying, hey, I mean, a lot of people say bullshit, like, you know, I'm going to call bullshit on you. And the guy's like, no, really, look what I can show you.
Right.
And that was his downfall, because the reporter would report on it. The thing is, on some level, it's interesting that the reporter didn't take, Stephen Tolio didn't take a bit more care in protecting his source, because it could have been a golden goose, you know? Like laying those eggs that would allow him to continue with these scoops on what the next technology was going to be, you know, rather than making him the story, take the data and use that as a story.
Right. Well, I think he did to a point. I don't know how I can't have to
or maybe no one would believe him if he did that. So he had to like talk about the source as well. That's something that happens to reporters.
Right. It was apparently a private investigator that Microsoft had hired, part of their IP crimes team, that eventually got this guy caught, basically unveiled his identity and got him caught.
Probably got DCI Luther. show up and take
them down. Anyway, I just thought this was a fascinating story. It's definitely worth a read. It's one of the most interesting. It's one of the most interesting sort of tech stories that I've read, like in-depth tech stories that I've read, ironically, since the Argo story that we talked about that was published in Wired. So,
and as we kind of quickly touched upon during our break, could make a interesting movie.
Yeah,
at least an interesting book, right? Like I could see this becoming a book before becoming a movie because it's already got the articles. I could see Stephen Doyle getting in with the Dylan and really putting together a story that's worth shopping around. Like so many, just like how the Argo thing started as an article, went to a book, and then became a film. I can see this totally becoming a long form piece of writing. You know, add more data to it, make it you know, make it a bit more understanding. Talk a bit more about how he got into the stuff.
Yeah,
and all these things. And I can see people being really compelled by that.
I would read it for sure. Okay, so moving on here. Reporting in BetaBeat, Ryan Holiday, who apparently, according to him, has dabbled in social media marketing to an extent himself, writes about what he suspects is the increasingly insufferable fakery of brands on Reddit. He says, despite the community's penchant for skepticism, Costco, Taco Bell, and a handful of startups have all made very conspicuous appearances on Reddit in the last year, not via paid ads, but through what at first glance appear to be organic and genuine discussions by Reddit users. But are they? Could they really be? He says, I'm suspicious and cynical. I very well may be seeing signs of undue influence where there's only rule-bending behavior. But then again, I've begun getting requests from clients about the possibility of orchestrating Reddit machinations. So because of this and because of what I've observed behind the scenes, I'll come out and say it. What's going on in Reddit these days has media manipulation all over it. And he says, for example, these are some of the examples that he cites. Some of the media manipulation is harmless, like brand messaging, which corporations spend billions to propagate, passing as content. For example, take Costco, which made the front page of Reddit multiple times via the Today I Learned subreddit. One post even featuring facts lifted straight from the Costco corporate site. Although they had amassed more than 40,000 upvotes and 3,000 comments chattering about how great Costco is. And it wasn't the only business getting love through the Today I Learned subreddit. Subaru let everyone know about its environmental concerns. Meanwhile, McDonald's dominated the section for weeks. Walmart, Air Jordans, Jell-O, DeLorean Motor Company, Netflix, Mountain Dew have shared the Reddit spotlight. And Volvo owns the most popular Today I Learned post ever, alerting everyone to its good deeds and indirectly marketing its cars as safe.
I think a big part of this is it's we call it magnetic content. They're working really hard to make sure that their message is getting out in a way that people like, which is very different than plastering their message on the side in like some random place on a web page. I think the big thing is it earned media or is it sponsored or paid for media?
Right.
If it's earned media, which it seems very much like it is, then they deserve to be just as much there as anybody else. They make products that people like. I mean, we are a consumer society and we have, you know, consumers are driving the fact that these companies are big mega corporations. They're driving it by their interest and their like and everything like that. If it's a question of they paid to be there and it's not explicit that they paid to be there, then we have a problem. It's not okay in America. And we really have to pull it off. But I really feel like the idea that they're able to get their message out in a way that you know, connects with geeky people who want facts. I mean, that's what Reddit is, right? It's a whole bunch of people who are skeptical, sure, but they want real facts. They don't just want marketing. That's pretty powerful.
Ryan Holiday goes on to say, he says that these aren't organic accidents or real fan-to-brand interaction. It's just fakery. There's too much of it for that not to be the case. And what's worse, the brands
are... Where's his data? There's too much of it for that not to be the case? Where's his data?
If you read the article, he's got a lot of different sort of examples to go by.
I looked at the article. I just couldn't see any hard data saying... you know, we know for sure that this was paid media and not earned media.
Right. Well, that, I mean, there's definitely that aspect of it, because it's hard to sort of nail that down because it is so organic feeling. And the difference between marketers like this, I thought this post was really interesting because of coming from my background, having been a Dig top submitter and seeing marketing on Dig, the difference between marketers on the old Dig and the marketers on Reddit is, on the old Dig, if you were suspicious about a post that might be connected to marketers, you only had to look as far as the URL, as most marketing attempts were page view driven. And Redditors are more savvy than that, and they can easily see through attempts to drive page views. What's happening here is more organic and insidious, as marketers appear not to be driving page views to URL, but to drive presence to whole brands, which has a cumulatively more significant and long-lasting effect.
Well, that's a good thing.
It's a good thing for the marketers, for sure.
No, it's a great thing, period. Look, if I'm a marketer, and my job, let's say I'm an advertising agency, and I go to Costco, and there's always agencies in between, like the publisher, Reddit, and the brand, Costco. I'm an agency, I go to Costco, and I say 5 years ago, 6 years ago, I'm like, I'll get you more page views. The click-through rate will be up through the roof. What is Costco really getting for that? Nothing. They're getting some people clicking on something. Oh, I saw this thing. I'm going to click away. No real action has been maintained. But if I can say, you know what? Let's get your brand to be part of a real conversation. In fact, why don't we base our worth as an agency on how well I can promote your brand in a real forum? Now, possibly I'm gaming the system of the forum in order to get it up there. But on some level, the earned media and the conversation surrounding it is such that the brand gets far more value than some people landing on its page and seeing whatever they've got promoted for the week.
No, so, I mean, there's no doubt about it that this is terrific value for marketers. But what if you are a member of the
Reddit? Terrific value for the brand. Forget marketers.
Sure. No, absolutely. For the brand and marketers. But what if you're a Reddit user and you don't want to be marketed to, that you don't want to see this on your site?
It all depends on how it gets there. Like, if it gets there because the vast majority of Reddit users have upranked it so that it gets to the top of the site, then you're in the minority. You know, like, you're clearly, it's not for you. But if it's a question of them paying for it, that's a little weird, and that's not okay.
And that's what
Just because he didn't like it doesn't mean a lot of other Redditors don't like it. Maybe Reddit is changing. Reddit has always been able to maintain a big audience because it's been able to pivot with what's going on. That's what Dig didn't do.
That's what Ryan Holiday points out in this article. He says that brands are engaging in stunts that could easily afford to pay for the ad space on those same pages. In other words, we're not talking about small creative marketing here. We're talking multi-billion-dollar corporations using their enormous marketing teams to overwhelm busy volunteer moderators. And meaning that one shill thread on photo on Reddit can quickly become pseudo-news and then real news across the web, spreading to blogs like BetaBeat, Business Insider, Huffington Post. And do readers understand and see the tainted origins of that content? Of course not, he says.
I don't know. I mean, I look at these Costco posts, and it talks about things like Costco auditing the companies it buys to see if working conditions are good. That's something that I would uprank.
Sure. It's very organic. It feels like something that – but, I mean, the net effect on all of that is your increasing presence to the brand, which is, of course, what the marketers and the brands want. But is it what you want to see on Reddit as a
– I guess what I'm saying is that I don't think we need to live in a world anymore where what the brand wants is contrary to what the user wants. And I say that because the idea that you can enlighten someone about a brand – based on a real fact, a real whatever, and not just saying, hey, look at me, I've got a goofy gimmick. I think that's a powerful thing, and that's the way you get brands to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like what he doesn't come into it from a place of impartiality, more of a place of like attack. Oh my God, these guys, it's so fake, whatever. And I kind of feel like that's There needs to be a bit more. There needs to be a bit more data before you come at it with that. It's just kind of like this idea that like advertising agencies and advertisers have pushed their message in the past, the whole entire 20th century. I'm pushing. I'm never going to stop pushing. And I've heard, you know, Patrick Roanhouse is like famous for saying that. Like it's a true thing. They push things and it gets in the way of what you really want. And this is the opposite of that.
I would agree. I think that, you know, on a certain extent, I think he takes it to the extreme, you know, to the 1984 extreme, uh-huh. Big Brother. right. They're in our news feeds, you know, stealing all our RSS and whatnot. And I think, you know, to a certain extent, it can be organic. You can let that thing perpetrate and grow on its own. Although I don't really necessarily like this example that I'm bringing up.
Yeah.
Remember when Burger King was hacked and switched to McDonald's?
Yeah, yeah.
And then another there were a couple organizations, but one of them was MTV.
And BET.
And BET, right? And then there may have been another one too. But, you know, that was their way of trying to be creative and also to a certain extent – you know, was able to hit the social network. So I think there are positive methods and there are also positive methods for the smaller people also calling out their story too. I don't think it shouldn't be this limited thing because, you know, nowadays we're all, to a certain extent, we're all kind of nerds. I like to talk about my organization because I love where I'm at in terms of work. And that shouldn't be something that I have to, you know, whenever I go into a social network, I have to actively not mention it. I should have some sort of freedom, but to a certain extent, I can also see that that long-term worry. I just don't think we're at that stage. I think this is also kind of goes in line with what we kind of talked earlier about, you know, having cameras and things all over the place. We've been able to survive as a species. We haven't gone down the dark ages of, you know, I mean, some people have, I guess. Some people are constantly worried about surveillance and everything. But I think the good will outweigh the bad.
Mm-hmm. And about surveillance, there was a time where you didn't need all these cameras and stuff for surveillance. Gossip was the way of the world, and you couldn't do anything in a small community without everybody knowing about it. We've gone away from that with this idea of privacy that's pretty brand new. I think that these guys are working with whatever content marketers perhaps, or even just perhaps like people who are really hardcore advocates of Costco because they love it, regardless. Until we can figure out how it's being done, if it's being done in a nefarious way, I feel like, you know, it's not so much Reddit spam as it may be indicative of a new interest on the forum. But it very well could be a whole bunch of college kids being paid $7 an hour to go and like uprank shit, right? And
if that clearly doesn't. That's the other difference too. Is that we've seen that clearly does not work on Reddit. Like Reddit's kind of immune to that. But this is a very sort of insidious, like I said, organic way of because I mean it doesn't hurt, but I mean.
Maybe there are a whole lot of people who are on Reddit who are getting paid. They're getting identified and they're getting a check in the mail.
I would consider this like a soft hammer, but a hammer nonetheless. The hammer of marketing nonetheless, but a very soft velvet hammer.
We just don't know what's behind it enough.
Right.
You know, I think it's important that it's been raised, that this article went into it. I think the slant of the article was a little off, a little unfounded, but it has to be looked at.
For sure.
If these guys are truly being able to get their message across in a way that moves Reddit people, then they have to be looked at across the board from other brands. If it's a way that they're gaming the system, then they have to be looked at across the board from both other brands and the people who run Reddit and the people who care about Reddit. Either way, it has to be looked at. It has to be investigated more. And that's one of the great things about the news. It's going to always take a look into something. I hope he keeps on with it. But I do want to stress that I feel like if it is in fact organic because people do like the brand, then, you know, don't hate, celebrate.
All right. I'll grant you that. All right, let's move on here. Every single day, Netflix, the by far the largest provider of commercial streaming video programming in the U.S., registers hundreds of millions of events on their service. As a consequence, the company knows more about our viewing habits than many of us realize. Netflix doesn't know merely what we're watching, but when, where, and what with what kind of device we're watching. It keeps a record of every time we pause the action or rewind or fast forward, how many of us abandon a show entirely after watching a few minutes. For almost a year, Netflix executives have told us that their detailed knowledge of Netflix subscriber viewing preferences clinched their decision to license a remake of the popular and critically well-regarded 1990 BBC miniseries House of Cards. Netflix's data indicated that the same subscribers who loved the original BBC production also gobbled down movies starring Kevin Spacey or directed by David Fincher. Therefore, concluded Netflix executives, a remake of the BBC drama with Spacey and Fincher attached was a no-brainer, to the point that the company committed $100 million for two 13-episode seasons.
That is so incredibly wonderful. That is the most wonderful thing I've read all week.
About the basically what we're talking about is using big data to decide which shows to license or which shows to create.
It's targeting done right. I have a set of data that shows me that people will be interested in this. I'm going to give those people what they want. They're going to stay on my service. It's wonderful. I mean, but, it's value for value.
It is definitely worked. It has worked for Netflix. It has worked for the consumers. But don't you feel a little sort of icky about
you again hating on the people who are
I'm
using
just
data to make your life
saying,
better?
No,
well,
I'm not
actually,
hating.
Here's a question.
Yeah.
Isn't this what like TV is supposed to do?
TV can't do it because TV's using these outdated tracking systems to determine what people like. And because Netflix has true data, and it's not just data on an individual. It's not like Netflix is chasing down Andy Sorcini and seeing what he likes. People in Andy's house use Netflix. So you've got his daughter looking at it. You've got his wife looking at it. You've got that. And that's an aggregate of a household, which is what those boxes try to do. But they don't do it very well. They're locked in a 20th century paradigm of surveys. If you're going to join a service that has all the capabilities that Netflix has, a big part of what you're getting is a group of people who are tuned to what you like. Not what you think you like, not what you pretend you like to be cool, not what you say you like because you want to fit in, but what you actually like. And we can begin to see society in a much clearer, much more defined way. Because you're basically saying, I like this show, I like Kevin Spacey, I like David Fincher. What if we put them all together?
Right.
And it was
an
experiment. They didn't know that it was going to work out. It could have been horrible. Oh, you know what? When you put I like chocolate milk, I like salmon, and I like pickles. But when I put them all together, it's disgusting. It didn't have to work out. You know?
Right.
Like, it takes smart people to figure out which company. I'm sure there are plenty of correlations around there. It takes smart people to figure that out. And it takes people who are in tune with the culture of their users, which Netflix is. And just like they found these three elements and put them together to make this show and make this show a success, I guess we'll see whether it was a success or not, they also took the culture of their users to determine that their users in an aggregate prefer to watch shows all at once, which is something we talked about earlier. So instead of doing – and this is where the data comes in. Instead of doing what society thinks it wants, instead of worrying about what other TV networks are going to complain about, oh, you can't release a show at once, it screws up our model. They don't care about how you feel or how you want to represent yourself. They care about how you actually are, which is probably the biggest problem I have in my life, looking at data before looking at what people want to say and pretend they are what they want to be. And I feel like what this just shows is that I'm going to make my show. I'm going to make it completely available at once because I know that's what people really want regardless of what they may say or what networks might say. And I know that these elements, these actors, this director, this storyline, people are going to respond to it in a positive way. At least that's what my data shows me. Let's give it a shot. And that – I don't see how anyone can look at that and say that that's a negative thing.
Yeah, I mean, I just sort of I'm in agreement with you. Any sort of position I take to the opposite would be merely to try and play devil's advocate. And in saying that, I mean, it kind of takes sort of the creative, like you're instead of developing a show created by an individual wholesale that was his particular you know, original idea, his or her particular original idea, you're using big data to like.
Let's take the word big out of it, because when you say big, it's like big tobacco and big oil and all these other big things. Right,
but you're using the data to create a show that it's kind of like computer.
It's commoditizing a creative process, and that makes you somewhat uncomfortable.
It's like computer dating. You know,
it's sort of like computer dating. The
numbers,
it's eliminating waste.
You may have a perfect match, but the chemistry may not be right when you get together, the two people
exactly. together. Exactly. And that's, I think you're absolutely right, which is why I said, you know, the pickle, salmon, and ice cream situation. You could get something gross out of it. There's compatibility and there's chemistry, and it works in every single relationship. It works with the relationships that we have between the people we're romantically in love with, and it works between the relationships that you have when it comes to a service coming out to you.
Sure. But
what I see here is, like, you look at a lot of TV shows that come out. There's hundreds of millions of dollars spent each year on a pilot because some person had some idea, and it's great, you know, like the idea that this freedom is around and this freedom is great and everything. That's really cool, but there's a lot of waste that happens out of that, and that makes every other single TV show more expensive.
Uh-huh.
Right, and that like the ability to use data to eliminate waste is a good thing, and I think that what Netflix is doing, and you know, I don't know this for sure. But I can say that this experiment, what they've done with House of Cards. It's an experiment that I think was, you know, only slightly ambitious. It was a no-brainer, right? That's what the article said, and I think it really was. What they need to begin doing, and what they probably will begin doing, is taking a closer look at what people like and enjoy, being able to infer from that what kind of range of things people would be interested in, and then using that range to create entirely new series, new products, and then getting the right people to direct them. David Fincher has proven himself as an independent person for a long time. The fact that he can walk onto a set with $100 million and an actor like Kevin Spacey isn't a question of like, oh, well, you know, it's all just driven by data. It's a boy band. It's fake. It's all manufactured. It says, these people like Kevin Spacey, like David Fincher, they've proven themselves in the marketplace.
Right,
and
right.
We're going to give them a budget based on our analysis. And that actually happens with nearly every movie you see. When they're thinking about Michael Bay, Transformers, they're not thinking, we want to make a critically acclaimed movie. They're thinking, how much money could we make off of this? How many people were born between this time and this time who know Transformers? And how many people are new? And how many people like science fiction? How many people like hyperviolence? Michael Bay's been proven at this, and this writer's been proven at that. We're going to put them together and see if we can't make something work. Netflix is just doing that in a highly quantified way,
right?
With a lot less guessing, and they're not too shy about it.
And
they're not trying to hide that.
And to Netflix's credit, they do say that they are fairly hands-off about that. I mean, even though the creation of the show came out of this analysis, they said that the actual creative decisions on the show will remain in the hands of the creators. They say, we don't get super involved in the creative side. We hire the right people and give them freedom and budget to do good work. So,
which is the opposite of what happens on a great TV show when the network comes in and turns it off, right?
Right, right.
Like the network is like, well, you know, Joss Whedon, it seems pretty cool, this idea, you know, of like this guy and like he's fighting vampires and he is a vampire. I get it. But why don't you just make every show that you're going to make a standalone episode from now? Why don't we put it on Friday night? Why don't we take this awesome character, Han Solo, but like, you know, if the war had gone wrong and he's out there and he's like smuggling, why don't we take him and put him on Friday night? And what happens? These shows die. Netflix is working with the data to take the great people and make a winner. And I, you know, I've seen part of House of Cards. I've liked what I've seen so far. Mm-hmm. I haven't been able to do the hardcore binge of it. But, you know, I think this can herald a new awakening in awesome TV. Imagine if you took the capacity of HBO's talent, you know, those actors and those directors and those writers, and you could apply this level of data to them. That's what Netflix is beginning to do, which is why, what did you say, Andy? You quoted a story not 4 or 5 weeks ago where the Netflix logistics guy said that we have to become HBO before HBO becomes us.
Right. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And just to think, I know I've harped upon this before, but a little over, was it a year ago that everyone was kind of calling to get rid of the CEO for Netflix and what's going on now? Go ahead.
Right.
Yeah, the stock's going up.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that's a big part of that is him looking at himself and possibly doing what the CEO of Groupon couldn't do, and saying, "Let me step back and let the people who are my experts help me figure out what's right for my show, for my situation here." And I feel like Reed Hastings, he had to take a serious look at himself when a lot of these people are people of character. They keep creatures of personality. They haven't ever lost, right? So Reed Hastings has kind of always done his own thing, and he's always been successful. So why not just give everything a try? When Netflix got that backlash from everybody and their mother, literally, I think there's no doubt that he had to take some time and take stock of himself and what he was trying to do and say, okay, let's see what I can do to make things, you know, how can I really optimize? Like, instead of me just going on my gut, like, what do we have at our disposal? Hey, board, hey, cabinet, what do we have? And these people came to him with ideas like this.
Netflix has definitely made that, they've gone over the tipping point over that sort of danger area that they were of being obsolete and being in trouble. And I remember when Amazon went through the same sort of stage when they were looked like they were going bankrupt and they didn't know what their future was going to be. And then they made that tipping point. And I'm happy that that Netflix was able to do this, because I personally love Netflix.
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't really know what I would do without it, to be honest, because I can't deal with cable anymore. But I do love big data. You know me. What do I say every freaking episode? Yes. Data, data, data. Just give me more data. You know, it quantifies itself.
Big data, and he cannot lie.
All right, let's talk about our last story here, and we've been trying to get this this new segment of the show going. Viral video of the week. And I want to bring this one up not only because it's a viral video and it's kind of it's a few weeks old, so it's a little bit of an older viral video, but the interesting thing about this is sort of the aftermath of this. And this is the viral video of the Golden Eagle who snatches the kid in the Montreal park. I don't know if you've seen this. I think everybody... It's gotten an amazing amount of views. But the thing about this, and I completely fell for this, 42 million views in total. I completely fell for this, is that I did not know that this was a hoax. So I completely fell for this as a real sort of thing. And essentially the video is fairly short. It's a handheld camera. It's in a Montreal park, and the camera is...
That's how you know it's a hoax. It took place in Canada.
It focuses on this golden eagle flying in the sky, and all of a sudden the golden eagle swoops down and picks up a kid. Everyone starts chasing after the eagle, and the eagle drops the kid on the ground, and the kid starts crying. Complete hoax. I completely fell for it.
I was in Canada, guys. I was in Canada not the weekend before last. It's Girl Scout cookie season, and I went to get – and these people were outside the supermarket, and they were little girls, and they're like, do you want to buy some cookies? And I was like, okay, sure. And so I bought the cookies, and they're like – they were like Thin Mints, but they weren't. They were thicker, and they were sold by the Girl Guides of Canada. They're all about hoaxes. Those little girls tricked me into thinking they were Girl Scout cookies, but they weren't.
Got to watch out for those Canadians.
Blame Canada. I can't trust them. The fascinating story about this was that this was perpetrated by a technology lecturer at Centre NAD in Montreal, Robin Tremblay, and he's been teaching a video effects class since 1992. In October, he challenged his students, as he did the previous two semesters, to make a viral hoax video. The goal being, if it got more than 100,000 views, then congratulations, you got an A in his class. So four of his most industrious students create a video called Golden Eagle Snatches Kids. 17 million views within a day, just shy of 42 million views total. Embedded on major news websites worldwide, broadcast on morning talk shows, linked on countless message boards, and of course they got an A. So, but this article, there's an article in BuzzFeed that goes into the creation of this video. So they shot their footage in a local park, and they ran the footage through different off-the-shelf programs, Autodesk, Softimage, Maya, and
French programs. That's why.
and digitally compositing software, and they were given the assignment on October 29th, and they turned it in on December 18th. Worked over 400 hours on the project, did some all-nighters, and essentially it's all, you know, the baby and the eagle are all CG, and the whole sequence is fairly fascinating. Anyway,
yeah, it's really impressive.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's really well done. There are some weak aspects, but overall the video is really well. I remember a few of my colleagues had sent this back and forth, and I think the best thing about it was just the quotes that we were getting. One of my colleagues was like, "Just like The Hobbit," after watching it, and then another of my colleagues was like, "You know, I feel I need to rewatch Rescuers Down Under to come up with a suitable joke," and it was just like, "Oh man, this is awesome." And then of course the required joke from the British comedy series about coconuts and a 10-pound bird.
Uh-huh,
you guys know
uh-huh.
what I'm talking about?
Ooh.
You're talking about Monty Python?
Yes, Monty Python. Yes. The question, it's a simple question of weight ratios. A 10-pound bird cannot carry a 15-pound baby.
Well, but let me ask you guys, because obviously hindsight is 20/20, but at the time, did either of you guys suspect this was a hoax?
So, personally, I wasn't sure. The video looked really good,
yeah.
And nowhere on the internet had they proven that it was a hoax. So I definitely enjoyed watching it and sharing it. But it was kind of one of those think about it for 15 minutes and then move on to something else for me.
Yeah.
The one thing which I kept looking at was like when the baby was dropped, like that portion, from what I can recall, didn't look as smooth as possible.
Uh-huh.
And also the whole scenario of like, could a bird that size really carry a baby that size?
Right.
I don't know.
Right.
But it was, I will say, it was really, really well done. So, one of the better hoaxes that we've had out there in a long time.
I think like part of the thing that sold it for me was how crappy the video quality was.
That's so key, right? Like,
yeah.
Every time you've seen like Nessie, the Loch Ness Monster,
yeah.
Or you know, the crazy, you know, the Yeti slash Bigfoot slash whatever the word they're going to use, Sasquatch. It's always like really shitty video.
Yeah. And the fact that, I mean, I've never seen anything like this in my life, but I've heard anecdotal stories about large birds carrying, you know, babies off. So
I've only heard about dingoes.
There's like a glimmer of truth to the idea that it could happen, I think.
I guess so. There's like that urban legend like hanging out in the culture that says, oh yeah, I've totally heard about that kind of thing.
I think it's just fascinating that there's this guy who teaches a class who, and he's essentially training people to create something viral. I mean, he's creating a whole class of talent out there who have experience in making viral content.
Yeah, I mean, I guess so. I feel like I've only been a part of one viral video ever, and it was a lot of work. But yeah, it's 7 million hits later, it's all right. But yeah, I really feel like what he's doing is also he's really showing people the power of special effects.
Yes.
Like in working to deceive the mass populace with this video that you make for a class, you're proving that you may have what it takes for Weta or Industrial Light and Magic or any of those places.
Right.
And I feel like it's a good way to train people. If you can trick the masses, then you can probably work for one of the companies that's job is to, dazzle the masses with, artificial stuff. So I think it's pretty powerful. I also think it's funny because, as I watched it, I thought of that one time at Amherst where some girl was like messing around with her guinea pig or her rabbit or whatever terrible animal.
Yes, I remember hearing about that.
And this hawk just scooped right down off the quad. It just never seen again.
God. That's awful.
And it's not, though. It's the circle of life. And there's no reason why you should have a rodent in your house.
I just never heard of whether or not, like, I couldn't hear if the hawk was able to be successful to get up.
Oh, it got away. That was the last time she saw it. It was on the freshman quad.
Really?
It was like one of those days where it was really warm in like the beginning of the year.
What year was it?
I think it was my freshman year.
Okay, because we, I graduated 08, and we heard stories of it early on.
It was 1998. It was like 10 years before you graduated. Yeah. It was like the 1998 year, but yeah, it was pretty something. And I mean, she wasn't even supposed to have the stupid rodent in her room anyway. So it's Valentine, people. That's what it is.
All right, let's wrap it up here. Let me go around the table here. I'll start with you, Dwayne. Where can we find your work online? Oh, Dwayne, before you talk, okay, so talk about your new project here.
I've been working on this for a long time, but yesterday the soft launch of commingle.me came out. We've been working on it for a little while. It's called Commingle. The website is commingle.me. Uh-huh. And what we have is a network for co-working spaces. So for all those freelancers out there that go to co-working spaces or even just like to work out of coffee shops or whatever, the idea is it's a location-based, proximity-based network that allows you to check into a space and let people know that you're there, what your expertise is and everything. In fact, you can sign up through LinkedIn or augment your profile with your LinkedIn information so you don't have to do a lot of double work. And when you're in there, you can see who else is in there. And suppose you're a person who's focused on marketing and you're a consultant that way, or you have an idea for a startup and you need some information regarding finances or tech or whatever, you can look up the people in the space and determine who they are and message them and say, hey, you have a moment to chat. I have a question for you or whatever. It gets you in a position where if you're in a co-working space or a popular like freelance coffee shop or whatever, you can communicate people without the awkwardness. First of all, you know who's there. Second of all, you can communicate with them without the awkwardness of kind of like walking over. Hi, I saw you were working on some sort of Excel thing. Do you know about it? You know, that kind of stuff goes away. So it's really designed to help make co-working more collaborative. And I feel like in a world that's becoming more and more flexible with how people live, despite what's going on with Yahoo, the idea was to really put together a situation where users could create and maintain a network that allows them to do all this sort of functionality. And we've got to expand it.
I love the fact that it finds other people who are near you who want to, so you can join sort of their networking hub. But I also love the fact that it lets you create a hub that you can, have other people join as well.
Yeah, I think that's the hugest thing, allowing users, because co-working is growing pretty quickly in this country. It's big in Europe, but it's growing pretty rapidly over the last few years. So the idea is like let's let people set that up. And also, as much as you have a co-working space dedicated, like here are my desks and here is my Wi-Fi and here's my printer and all that stuff, there are people who find places to work, and those places have different cultures and stuff. And so what Commingle is supposed to let you do is allow you to define what those places are, even if they're not official co-working spots. And you can say what it is and why you like it and, just let people know. And that's what's so exciting about it. You kind of grow, you're growing the co-working movement and you're making that flexibility happen. So we've got, right now we're pretty small. We've got 4 people and we're excited about it. The launch has gone pretty well. We're still working out a lot of the kinks. So anyone listening, if you want to go to commingle.me, sign up and try to break it and send us an email at the Jill Down letting us know where it was you were able to break it. They'll pass it on to me and I'll be able to make sure it works better.
You heard it here first. So if your commingle is broken when we see the next hear this post, then we know it was everyone's fault for going online. Where else can we find you on the internet besides commingle.me?
You can check me out at Twitter. I'm on Twitter at twitter.com/Dwayne D, DWAYNED. You can also check out a lot of what I do at flavors.me/Dwayne D. Once again, Dwayned.
And Tosin, how about yourself? Where can we find your stuff online?
You can find me online, spending a majority of my time at twitter.com/TOAST4321, Toast4321, as well as you can find me talking about movies and all sorts of randomness at ircwebcast.blogspot.com.
As for myself, Google Mr. Babyman and you'll find all my social links. The other podcast that I'm involved with that I talked about a few weeks ago, Parageekology.com, has finally launched our first it's not a full episode. It's more like a pre-launch episode. It's our zero episode, our introductory episode, where we talk about our mission statement of what the podcast is going to be about. So I invite everyone to check that out, parageekology.com. And follow us if you want to hear more about parapsychology and technology and the merging of the two. As for the show, you can find past episodes of the Drill Down, as well as other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to Geeks of Doom, and our iTunes link is in the upper right-hand sidebar. Our show's on Stitcher. Go to Stitcher.com for that, Facebook.com/TheDrillDown, Twitter.com/TheDrillDown. If you got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@TheDrillDown.com. If you got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@TheDrillDown.com for us to publish on the site. Let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And, you know, drop us a line because we really want to hear from you and hear what you think of the show, how you think it's going. If you like the show, I think more importantly than that, if you like the show, tell other people and have them subscribe to the show as well. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And thanks for joining us.
I never told you guys about the Landis Society.
Was it like a whole bunch of black science fiction geeks?
Well, no. But it's a whole bunch of people in Lando t-shirts and Lando capes. And
this is a thing. This is like a cultural phenomenon. Yeah, Lando Society. And you're a part of it. You walk around with a cape and a Jerry curl.
His life story. As we praise it, speaking his words and deeds. But wait a minute. Wasn't he a traitor?
Lando? Not really. He wasn't a traitor.
He sold his friends down the river.
But he wasn't a traitor. He never claimed that he was against the Empire.
No, that's true. You're right. I mean, there's a distinction there. But he did sell his friends out.
He basically did what he had to do to protect his city.
I suppose.
Yep.
And he take out the fucking Death Star.
He did.
Like, he took out the second Death Star.
This Death Star 2.
He threw a ship that was probably six times the size of all the other ships into a Death Star, managed to blow it up,
right.
Even though he had to wait until the shields were down. Like, the man is a hero.
He is.
All right. I'm not going to argue that.
He was classic in charge of the entire assault.
I would be on a bad side of an argument if I tried to argue that Lando is not a hero.